underlie all our acts of aggression. What is clear is that holding in mind what has hurt us in the past is a survival mechanism, a way of trying to make sure it won't creep up on us again while we're off guard. The mind holding on to grievance is like a full-time sentry guard whose job is to remain on the lookout for emotional threats from other people. Simply put, we don't want to be wounded again like we were before, once long ago. Most of the time the sentry quietly goes about his patrol and we're not even aware he's on duty. But then when someone crosses us, slights us, ignores or hurts us, the alarm bells go off. As this alarm runs through our nervous system, it triggers an upsurge of charged emotion, and then we swing into some aggressive or defensive maneuver. Anger, blame, attack, withdrawal, or flight, to fend off this threat. A less dramatic, more recurring symptom of grievance at work is our perpetual tendency to judge other people. Have you ever noticed how many judgmental or blaming thoughts pass through your mind every hour of every day? Usually it's hard to be aware of just how many judgments we have of others unless we slow down and observe the mind more carefully. The first words out of the mouth of an 18-year-old I know at the conclusion of her first silent meditation retreat were, "I never realized before just how judgmental I was." Why all these judgmental thoughts? Standing in judgment of others is a way to feel superior by placing ourselves above them. Yet why on earth would we need to feel superior unless we also somehow felt inferior deep within, and we're trying to compensate for that? Judging others allows me to feel righteous and one-up, which shields me from the pain of their judgment and rejection of me. In judging them, I neutralize their power over me. So here again we see the wound at work. Judging and condemning others is an attempt to avoid experiencing the pain and fear of not feeling loved. And so our judgmental thoughts arrive, like automatic interest payments that we continually receive on our investment in grievance. Unfortunately, they take us away from being right here in the present, the only place where real love and happiness can happen. The mind that scans the environment for threats, insults, and things we don't like keeps us edgy and tense, preventing us from opening up and letting love in. The bad other. An important step in releasing ourselves from the grip of grievance is to recognize the linchpin that holds it in place, the fixation on the bad other. The bad other is our internal image of the one who doesn't love us or treat us well. It can be seen operating in our tendency to be on the lookout for wrongs directed at us. Unless we bring this inner image to consciousness and see how much we focus on other people as potential threats, this tendency will operate unconsciously, forever poisoning our relations with others. Let's look at how the bad other image forms in the mind. As young children, we totally depended on our parents for everything. When receiving our mother's care, we formed a sense of the good mother within us. Yet since no mother can ever be totally attuned to her child, we also had experiences of a mother who neglected, frustrated, or hurt us. Young children have no way to comprehend how a parent can be good, a source of pleasure and happiness one minute, and bad, a source of pain and frustration the next. It requires a great deal of maturity to hold a balanced, nuanced picture of other people that includes both their pleasing and unpleasant qualities. If children had this maturity, they might be able to say to themselves, "I'm feeling neglected right now, but I can see that my mother is having a hard time. She is burdened and pressured herself. She has had a hard life, and having a young child is bringing up all of her own unresolved conflicts and needs. So the fact that she can't be there for me right now doesn't mean anything bad about her or about me." If children were capable of that kind of understanding, there would be no need for psychotherapists. Since young children are so totally dependent on their parents, they need to see them as good. Seeing the parents as bad would undermine the child's sense of safety and security. So children usually drop their experience of the frustrating, hurtful mother out of awareness, and it falls into the shadow of unconsciousness, from whence it emerges in fairy tales as the wicked witch or evil stepmother, or on the male side as the malevolent giant or ogre. This is how children protect their connection with the good mother, the one who feeds and cares for them, and maintain their equilibrium. But whenever any aspect of our experience falls into unconsciousness, it takes on a life of its own, growing in the darkness like mold silently spreading through a basement. Thus, the repressed sense of the frustrating or neglectful parent eventually blossoms into a more generalized sense of the bad other, the other who cannot love you as you are, who threatens to hurt or betray you, and therefore cannot be trusted. In this way, the bad other takes up permanent residence in the shadows of the mind. This explains one of the most disturbing and perplexing experiences that crop up in intimate relationships. One moment two lovers can feel sweet and loving, and then, with the exchange of but a few words, they can be at each other's throats. How can the honeymoon glow of new love dissolve so quickly into mutual acrimony and recrimination? How can two people who claim to love each other more than anyone else in the world turn against each other so suddenly, reacting with violent aggression or fright, as though they were the worst of enemies? This instant enmity has shaken many a lover into wondering whether he or she has gone stark raving mad, or whether the beloved is actually a Jekyll Hyde monster. What is even more mystifying is that these flare-ups are often triggered by the most trivial incidents, such as a partner's showing up 10 minutes late. These explosions of rage and blame happen when the bad other image and its painful associations suddenly emerge into consciousness and become projected on the one we love. It's as though our full-time security guard keeps a most wanted criminal poster on the wall and is constantly scanning the environment for signs of this villain. So whenever our partner acts, speaks, or treats us in a way that even slightly fits this profile, it triggers a deeply submerged sense of alarm, and we shift into fighting for all we're worth. Suddenly we see those we care about as the living embodiment of everyone who has ever hurt or rejected us. I knew I never should have trusted you. You're just like all the rest. I'll show you that you can't treat me like this. And even worse, as we retaliate with blame or aggression, this sets off our partner's alarms. He or she then reacts to us in turn with defensiveness or aggression, which further justifies our bad other story, and the conflict escalates from there. A woman has had a stressful day at work, and that evening happens to be the time her lover chooses to reach out to her in a highly intimate way. When she doesn't respond in the way he had hoped, he sees her as an embodiment of all the unresponsive people in his life, starting with his mother, who were too caught up in their own world to show interest in him. So he suddenly goes cold and says something nasty. He has become so swept up in reactive emotion that he doesn't realize he's not even seeing his partner. Instead, he's projecting an image of the bad other onto her, based on his old wound. In truth, she may care deeply about him and their potential for greater intimacy, but he can't see that right now, because his ancient bad other picture is occupying the screen of his awareness. Road rage is another common instance of how old grievances against the bad other can spring to life full-blown at a moment's notice. Why else would perfectly nice people suddenly turn into monsters behind the wheel? The faceless driver who cuts in front of you represents everyone who hasn't treated you with caring or kindness. And as you lean on the horn or yell obscenities, you want to let this person know you're not going to take it anymore. A therapist I know told a funny story about driving to work and taking a parking space that another driver coming from the other direction had been eyeing. The other driver started honking his horn and then leaned out the window to make an obscene gesture, when he suddenly saw that the person he was yelling at was his therapist. Needless to say, they had an interesting session that afternoon. Modern warfare, like road rage, is another vehicle for enacting ancient grievances about feeling mistreated, especially when war is waged with technology, with little person-to-person contact. it becomes easy to project the bad other onto an enemy people that have no face. In demonizing the enemy, war draws popular support from the grievance mentality smoldering in the populace at large. What underlies all the war rhetoric is, I don't feel important, I don't feel properly recognized, honored, or respected. I haven't been given my due, I'm angry about that, and I'm going to show those bastards they can't push me around. In belligerence against other nations, a people may use bombs and missiles to compensate for a deep sense of powerlessness, helplessness, and frustration that, if we trace it all the way back, is rooted in the wound of the heart. In personal relationships, subconscious bad other images cause people to overemphasize and overreact to the ways their partner is not attuned to them, while minimizing or overlooking the ways the other does love or care for them. Often there is one aggrieved partner who tends to complain, while the brow-beaten partner tends to withdraw to ward off the onslaught. This was what was happening with Dan and Nancy. After years of defending himself against Nancy's complaint that he didn't love her, Dan learned through our work together to show up and be more attentive and present with her. I have witnessed this countless times, the withdrawn partner finally coming forward to meet the aggrieved partner in a beautiful, fresh moment that I often find quite moving. I sit there feeling, wow, that's so great. He, she, finally took the risk and showed up. But then to my dismay, the aggrieved partner hardly seems to notice. Once, when Dan made himself emotionally available to Nancy, she held firmly to her grievance. I don't trust this. I can't imagine it will last when we leave your office. While her concern was understandable, she was also bringing it up in a way that kept Dan at bay, thereby justifying her complaint. This is what is tragic about the mood of grievance. It shuts down the channel through which love could enter into us, cutting us off from its healing and regenerative power. In one way or another, many of us suffer from the same problem as Nancy. I don't feel loved, eventually hardens into, I don't trust love enough to let it in. Opening to love feels too threatening, and we don't believe it's safe to do so. The final step in sealing ourselves into this box is to cover up our emotional vulnerability with blame or condemnation. You don't really love me. You don't know how to love. Thus, the mood of grievance is totally self-defeating, not only shutting us down to love, but also driving others who are the target of our complaint away. In treating Dan as the bad other who couldn't be there for her, Nancy triggered his own inner freakout about being unworthy and unlovable. This brought up shame and self-blame, making it harder for him to be open to her. In that contracted condition, he also had little to give, and the less he could give, the more Nancy felt justified in her grievance. Meanwhile, his bad other projection on Nancy, that she was impossible, made it harder for her to soften as well. This is how grievances invariably become self-fulfilling prophecies. One American psychiatrist, Vamik Volkan, has studied how this mindset operates in certain ethnic groups and nations that define themselves in terms of a victim identity based on historic wrongs and oppressions. Volkan uses the term chosen trauma to describe this phenomenon. Looking at the world through the lens of their chosen trauma, such groups are continually on the lookout for dangers and threats from some other ethnic group. This makes them act in defensive and aggressive ways that generate fear and animosity in the other group, which then reacts in hostile ways, thereby confirming the first group's view of the world as unfriendly. In a similar way, we all harbor our own chosen trauma about not getting enough love, and our story about the bad other who has wronged and deprived us generates fear, suspicion, resentment, distrust, or aggression that inevitably pushes others away and undermines our relationships, thereby reconfirming the old belief that we're not loved or lovable. Thus, we keep reenacting the child's original love trauma by continually generating fresh evidence that the world is indeed a loveless place. Grievance run amok. One of the most insidious things about grievance is that it takes on a life of its own and poisons everything, cutting us off from the joy and beauty of life. What started out as a hurt feeling turns into a generalized grudge against the world. My mother provided me with an up-close study in how grievance becomes generalized into a whole way of being. Although she had a big heart and was basically very kind and generous, she had had a very hard childhood, and as she grew older, she began to dwell in grievance as a way of life. In the last half of her life, she always had something to complain vociferously about, whether it was politicians, the weather, the food she ate, her relatives, her doctors, or the apartment in which she lived. At a moment's notice, she would launch into long, bitter tirades about any of these things. At these times, there was no reasoning with her, and she would brush aside any of my attempts to provide a more balanced, less negative view of things. Toward the end of her life, when she was being taken care of by home health aides, many of whom were immigrants, she would complain about how awful it was that there were so many immigrants in America. Yet whenever one of them showed up to help, she was actually quite kind and sweet to them. There was one Jamaican woman whom my mother was particularly fond of and grateful toward. I saw that in the moment of relating to someone personally, her heart could be present in a direct, pure way, even though at other times she might include these same people in her tirades against the bad other. Grievance had become so woven into her identity and psyche that it had taken on a life of its own, remaining split off from her awareness and even from her actual behavior. In observing my mother, as well as the tendencies I inherited from her, I saw how grievance can take on a life of its own. It doesn't matter whom the grudge is directed toward, because the target can change with the circumstances. It becomes a movable grievance. A few years before my mother formed her grievance against immigrants, she had one against gays and lesbians, and people on welfare before that, and men with long hair before that. As grievance generalizes, it finally becomes a complaint about the way things are and the injustice of it all, which winds up isolating us from life altogether. The investment in grievance. Given that grievance exacts such a heavy toll, what makes it so compelling and hard to let go of? Wanting to explore this more fully, I brought this question to the students in my group the week following their exploration of how the stress in their lives was based in old grievances arising out of their core wound. Now that we've looked at the painful and destructive consequences of grievance, I said, I'd like you to check something else out. See if you are willing to let go of your grievance. Please be honest. Who's willing to do that right now? There was silence. Not a single person raised a hand. I said, good. Thank you for your honesty. Before we can find a way to let our grievances go, it's essential to acknowledge how attached we are to them. We need to understand our whole investment in grievance and see exactly why we hold on to it so tightly. I then asked them to pair up and explore with each other what was good about holding on to grievance. In other words, what purpose did it serve? What was the benefit or payoff it provided? What did they get out of maintaining it? Here are some of the answers people came up with. Holding on to my grievance gives me a sense of power, which protects me from feeling vulnerable. It's a way of standing up for myself and defending myself from being hurt, disappointed, or rejected again. It keeps me vigilant against recurrences of harm. Holding on to a grudge lets me feel right and righteous. It's as if I have my own private jihad. Giving it up would be a way of letting the people who hurt me off the hook and letting them walk all over me. Grievance bolsters a familiar sense of me. I know myself in this place. It gives me a sense of identity, even though it doesn't actually feel good. I'd rather live with this familiar discomfort than let the grievance go and feel the discomfort of stepping into the unknown. Letting it go would undermine my whole identity. It's a way of saying poor me and feeling sorry for myself, so it becomes a way of trying to get some sympathy. It's a cry for help. Holding on to a grievance is a way of taking care of myself, of soothing myself, by shifting my attention away from the wound In this sense, it's self-affirming. It's a way of bonding with the members of my family, who all harbor some complaint against the world. My family were immigrants who were mistreated in Europe for many generations, and again when they first arrived in America. Voicing our grievances is a way of licking our wounds together. Being victims together is a membership card in the family. It provides an organizing principle, a unifying story about exploitation, oppression, haves versus have-nots, and fighting to get what you need, which gives me a worldview, a sense of what I need to fight for. This provides a sense of order and purpose in the midst of chaos. My grievance is bound up with feelings of being abandoned by my father, who left our family when I was young. Oddly enough, holding on to it helps me maintain some emotional connection with him. I can see how my anger and resentment are a way of trying to hold on to him. Shifting the blame onto others allows me not to have to take responsibility for my own problems. No wonder it's so hard to let go of our grievance and forgive. These statements show the powerful functions it can serve in the psyche. If we have a grievance ready at hand, it can protect us from feeling vulnerable. We can avoid putting ourselves in situations like the one that originally hurt us. Hardening around grievance gives us a certain righteous strength. I'll show you that you can't mess with me. I'll show you I'm someone to be reckoned with. It seems to provide a place to stand. Furthermore, as a way of making others bad or wrong, grievance is also a way of trying to feel better about ourselves. That was why my mother indulged in complaining about people whom she actually liked in person. Complaining about the bad other let her feel righteous, and thus good, about herself. Criticizing others' faults was a way she could access some power, to compensate for how small and helpless she felt inside. It gave her a sense of being somebody in a world where she felt totally at sea. All of this sheds light on why it is often hard to let ourselves receive love, even when it's available. To let love in requires us to melt, to dissolve our hardened defenses and let down our guard. Receiving love is more threatening than giving it, because receptivity requires opening, which feels vulnerable. So even though we may cry out for love, as Nancy did with Dan, when love is actually available, we often sabotage the relationship, shut down in fear, or provoke a conflict that will justify our grievance. Then we can feel safe again, righteously justifying our shutdown as a way to protect ourselves from the bad other. No wonder nations so quickly demand an eye for an eye and march off to war to settle disputes. If we, as individuals, are not ready to give up our personal grievances, how can we condemn our leaders for waging war, since we nurture the same seeds of violence within ourselves? To the extent that we indulge in the mood of grievance, each of us is implicated in the strife that dominates our planet. This is why Jesus' injunction to turn the other cheek is such an important teaching. It strikes at the heart of the grievance mentality, which is the core of the defensive ego, around which our sense of identity and security is built. When I present these ideas about grievance in workshops, people often ask, "What about legitimate grievances that have to be addressed, such as social injustice or oppression or abusive relationships?" Certainly there are legitimate wrongs and injustices that require attention and action. However, if we come from the mood of grievance, insisting on our virtue while condemning the badness of those who wrong us, we are unlikely to address these concerns in a constructive way that leads to true peace and justice. The Dalai Lama, for example, has as much to be aggrieved about as anyone in the world. As the exiled leader of Tibet, which was brutally invaded and occupied by China in the 1950s, he has witnessed the desecration and destruction of all that he held most dear, his people, his culture, the free practice of his religion, and the land and wildlife of Tibet. The Chinese occupation has been responsible for the torture and murder of up to 2 million Tibetans, and this living Holocaust continues to this day. The Dalai Lama has worked tirelessly to redress this situation, but he has made a choice not to live in a mind state of grievance, bitterness, or resentment. Far from it, he lives and breathes joy and directs compassion toward the Chinese invaders, out of concern for the great harm they are doing themselves by acting so hatefully. He knows that the mood of grievance confers no benefit whatsoever, for himself or for anyone else. And he makes an all-important distinction. He recognizes evil actions without regarding the people who perform them as intrinsically bad. He understands that people are usually unconscious and therefore helpless in the face of the karmic forces that propel their hurtful behavior. His understanding accords with that of Jesus' words on the cross, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." No doubt the Dalai Lama's great popularity stems from his living embodiment of Christ's injunction to turn the other cheek. Although few of us possess this level of strength and courage, nonetheless, the Dalai Lama's example shows us that human beings can conduct themselves with great dignity in the face of horrendous suffering and injustice. After my students finished exploring their personal investment in grievance, I asked them to acknowledge their unwillingness to let it go and see what that felt like. A few people judged themselves harshly for this, but they could also see that this was just another form of grievance against themselves. Most of the others felt a sense of relief about seeing the truth. As one woman put it, "It makes me feel hopeful. Seeing how I'm so invested in grievance gives me a concrete sense of what I need to work on in myself. And I see how important that is if I want to have real freedom and love in my life." Understanding this opens up whole new possibilities. Chapter 3. Letting Grievance Go. I was born when all I once feared I could love. Rabia. The heart is itself its own medicine. The heart all its own wounds heals. Hazrat Inayat Khan. How can we free ourselves from the mood of grievance, which only serves to perpetuate the wound of love by reinforcing fear and resentment of others? There is a powerful teaching from the tantric traditions of India and Tibet that can help us here. The medicine can be found within the poison. If grievance is like a poison, this teaching suggests that the cure lies in the grievance itself. So instead of looking outside ourselves for something to blame, we need to be willing to look within and to face what lies there in the heart of the grievance. What lies at the core of all grievance is deep pain and grief about loss of connection. Because we have never fully and consciously grieved this hurt, it becomes coagulated in our mind and body. What we fail to grieve turns into grievance. To extract the medicine that can heal the poison of grievance, we need to acknowledge and allow this grief instead of running away from it. This means bringing our grief about loss of connection out of the shadows into the daylight of openness and warmth. Melting grievance into grief. At first, of course, we do not know that our hurt is bearable. No one has ever modeled for us how to bear pain in a strong, dignified, or fruitful way, so the automatic reaction is to deny our grief and fashion a cool facade to cover it up. Yet behind the facade, there lies a simple truth, a running sore, a wound we share with billions of other people on this planet. We don't know in our bones that we are loved or lovable, that reality is ultimately benevolent, or that great love is the ground of our whole existence. To turn away from our hurt is to abandon and thus re-wound ourselves. The only way to heal the wound of the heart is through freeing up the feelings about loss of connection that remain stored in our body, so that they can be fully digested and move on through us. We first experienced loss of connection in relation to our parents, then again with friends who turned away, lovers who lost interest, or a husband or wife who shut down or left. Yet deeper still is the loss of connection with ourselves that happens when we spurn our own hurt confusion, or despair. This creates inner division and discord that prevent us from fully recognizing our intrinsic beauty and lovability and establishing a blessed connection with ourselves. I am not suggesting that you must go through an elaborate grieving catharsis for your past losses, though that might be helpful for some. What is more important is to acknowledge the truth, your separation from love, and the pain of that, and to open your heart to yourself in the place of unlove. Learning to hold your woundedness in the embrace of your own compassionate presence helps you be present to yourself in a new way that penetrates the thick defensive shell around the heart. This is what allows the medicine to flow. Meeting yourself in the place of unlove. How to hold your pain in a way that heals? The two dimensions of holding, discussed earlier, are important here. Making contact and giving space, letting be. To illustrate how this works, I will draw on a condensed example of work with one of my psychotherapy clients. Jane's situation and feelings were classic, and the sequence she moved through was also fairly typical. Following along with this example will help you start to see how you can work with your own wounding in a similar way. Jane was with a man who was not sure he wanted to continue the relationship, and his ambivalence had persisted for more than a year. She very much wanted the relationship, and Tom's ambivalence kept triggering and aggravating her old wound of, "I'm not good enough to be loved and wanted." In that wounded place, she would lose connection with herself and fixate intensely on Tom, on how he was treating her or how she could convince him to stay. Jane spent our first few sessions together laying out her grievances about Tom and describing her childhood experience of not feeling seen or accepted in her family. After we had established a groundwork of trust and understanding, I asked Jane to tune into her sense of not feeling loved as she experienced that in her body. At first, she could only contact her defensive shell. "I feel shut down and guarded." When I asked her to see what was under that, she got in touch with her fear and desperation about being left. After working with this for a while, it became clear she was still entirely focused on Tom and what he might do. Jane still hadn't made contact with what was being touched and triggered inside her that made her so fearful and desperate. Eventually, she said, "I hate feeling like this." "Feeling like what?" I asked. "So unloved." "How does that feel in your body?" I was inviting her to make direct contact with her bodily felt experience of the pain of feeling unloved. This direct contact is what I call acknowledging. This is the first step of meeting and inhabiting one's experience, a process I call unconditional presence. This process can be divided into four closely related steps: acknowledging, allowing, opening, and entering. These steps are a way of defining different moments in a process of ever greater presence with emotional experience. Acknowledging means recognizing what is there, recognizing that it is, without trying to assess whether it is good or bad, or whether it should be this way or not. Seeing and touching a feeling that is there, as it is. This is what I mean by acknowledgement. In my work as a psychotherapist, I have found that this simple act of acknowledgement possesses far greater power than any self-help strategy or mental analysis. "How does it sit in you right now, the feeling of being unloved?" I asked. "There's some soreness here," Jane said, touching her chest. "Can you let the breath touch that soreness? See if you can just let the feeling be there without trying to fix or change it." I was inviting her to take a further step, to allow the feeling. "See if you can soften around it, holding the soreness very softly and spaciously, like the sky holds the earth." Allowing means giving the feeling plenty of space to be there, just as it is, while continuing to stay in contact with it. Often we unconsciously compress or constrict painful feelings as a way of trying to keep them away or make them smaller and less consequential. Allowing is a form of decompression or unstuffing, letting the energy of the feeling be as large as it is Without either identifying with it, this pain is me. It means something about who I am. Or rejecting it. This pain isn't me. It shouldn't be there. When Jane could give her pain room to be there, this provided an immediate sense of relief, because she was no longer in a struggle with it. She was meeting and connecting with the wound of love as a simple human feeling rather than as a big melodrama. Occasionally, Jane would drift off into mental judgments or stories about the pain. It is important in this process not to become caught up in these mental interpretations or dramas. This feeling is too much. It's bigger than I am. It will swallow me alive. Because they interfere with meeting your experience directly. This is especially true with harsh judgments. If I feel so unloved, it means I'm no good. I helped Jane to recognize these judgments as stories she was telling herself, and then to gently put them aside and come back to sensing the present feeling in her body. Next, I encouraged Jane to see if she could open herself to the painful sense of not feeling loved. Opening in this context means opening one's heart to a feeling, letting oneself fully experience the sensations stirring in the body without maintaining any struggle against them. After spending some time opening to the feeling, she said, "I feel more calm. The ache is still there, but I can let it be there." Opening herself to the pain had allowed her to settle down with it, so it no longer felt so threatening. After a while, I invited Jane to go a little further, to enter into the felt sense of unlove and inhabit it fully. Entering means bringing one's awareness right into the core of a feeling, so that one is at one with it, no longer seeing it as something apart from oneself. Can you let your awareness enter into the ache, as if you're moving right into the center of it? "It feels really sad and vulnerable," she said. "Yes. See if you can be one with the sadness. Don't remain separate from it. See if you can soften into it." She fell silent for a few minutes. Eventually, she said, "The sadness is still there, but it's not so heavy." In a little while, she sat up straight and looked at me. "It's shifting. I still feel the vulnerability, but there's also more tenderness and warmth." Her face had totally relaxed, and she was obviously more settled in her body. "How are you experiencing yourself now?" "It's strange. There's some sweetness there," she said, with a tentative smile. "With that sweetness there, do you still feel disconnected from love?" I asked. Jane considered this quietly for a while and then said, "Not right now." No longer focused on Tom or their relationship, Jane was feeling her own heart, which ushered her into a lovely sense of sweetness in the body. Meeting herself in the place of unlove and opening to her pain and vulnerability had kindled love within her, as a subtle presence of sweetness and warmth entering into her darkest corners. What had clouded Jane's access to her own heart was her fear of the pain of unlove and her attempts to convince Tom to stay so she wouldn't have to feel this pain. She now realized that trying so hard to get Tom to love her had only separated her from love by turning it into something that was in his hands to confer upon her. As a result, whenever Tom would turn away, she felt cut off from her very heart. And that disconnect from the blessed flow of love within herself was the greatest heartache of all. So whenever you feel unloved, instead of looking for some external remedy, you could take this as a sign that you're disconnected from your own heart. That disconnect is the poison. Letting yourself open to the pain of that disconnect puts you in touch with a certain tenderness or vulnerability, which is a signal that your heart, with its natural longing and capacity to connect, is close at hand. This brings you back to yourself, which is the medicine for the disconnect. The pain of unlove is thus much more than just pain. It is a direct cry from the heart. "You've lost touch with me. Please come and find me, your life's blood." Of course, feeling unloved is usually the last thing we want to experience, because we associate it with deficiency, isolation, emptiness, shame, or inadequacy. Why on earth, you may wonder, would you want to let yourself feel unloved? Yet if this feeling is there, there are only two choices, avoiding and denying it, or facing it directly. If you flee from the wound, you only give it more power over you. Eventually, your emotional body becomes like an abandoned, haunted house. The more you flee the pain of unlove, the more it festers in the dark, and the more haunted your house becomes. And the more haunted it becomes, the more it terrifies you. This is the vicious circle that keeps you cut off from and afraid of yourself. But when you can meet yourself in the place of unlove, this starts to open the doors and windows of the haunted house, letting in sunlight and fresh air. Gradually, the house becomes more livable. Through learning to tolerate painful or vulnerable feelings, you develop a new muscle. With your growing capacity to handle your pain, the wound that once seemed so huge, so monstrous, so overwhelming, becomes tolerable. By meeting yourself in the place where you feel unmet, something new and powerful happens. Something so simple yet so radical, you start to inhabit yourself. You re-inhabit your lonely heart and bring it back to life. Owning your anger or hatred. Allowing and inhabiting the grief at the core of grievance reconnects us with the feminine tenderness of the heart, releasing healing medicine that softens the hard-heartedness of grievance. Yet there is another resource we also need to tap if we are to stop investing in grievance, masculine power and strength. This power stems from standing in our truth, what is deeply true for us. Standing in this power frees us from regarding others as a threat. Nursing grievance promotes a certain hardening that masquerades as strength, but that actually keeps us in the disempowered victim stance of, "They did me wrong." In this mind state, our strength is locked up in impotent rage and hatred about how we've been treated. Yet there is also potent medicine, vital power and no-nonsense clarity, hidden within the poison of aggression. In order to extract this medicine from the poison, we need to relate to the anger and hatred dwelling within us in a more conscious, deliberate way. My work with Jane eventually led in this direction. After a few weeks of working with her grief, Jane came in and said, "I notice that I still feel like a victim when Tom doesn't hear me." What actually happens inside you when he doesn't hear you? I used to erupt in anger when that happened, but that went nowhere and was too painful, so now I just shut down and become cold. Freezing like this cut Jane off from her power, keeping her stuck in the victim position. I encouraged her to let her anger come forward, and we worked with it in the way we had with her grief, acknowledging it, giving it plenty of room to be there, and opening to its intense energy. Making friends with her anger was helpful, but after working with her anger like this, I could also sense a deeper frozenness in her. So I asked her if there was something else there, something more like hatred. At first, Jane didn't want to go there, because of a strong moral belief that it was wrong to hate. So we talked about hatred as a feeling, which, like any feeling, is neither right or wrong in itself, and Jane could see how hatred became particularly problematic when it went underground, where it coagulated and became converted into a toxic story about the bad other. In a little while, Jane said, "Yes, I do hate Tom when he refuses to listen to me." I said, "See if you can feel the energy in the hatred itself without focusing so much on Tom or what he's doing. Let yourself feel it as an energy rather than as a grievance story. Give the feeling plenty of breathing room. Let it expand and radiate and see what happens." After sitting with the energy of hatred in her body and breathing deeply, she began to speak of how she had felt like this when her father would come home from work and not pay attention to her. She recognized how she had taken that personally, imagining she was unworthy of his attention, and how this had left her feeling helpless and at his mercy. "I've never been able to admit this hatred toward my father before," Jane said. Uttering these words with some force seemed to lift a weight from her shoulders, I'm glad you can feel this now, I said. It was clear that her hatred had frozen up inside and become turned against herself, and that owning it like this was an essential step in releasing herself from it. Jane straightened up, and I asked her what was happening. She said, I feel more solid, more contained. I invited her to describe this more. There's an upright feeling, like I'm in my core. That feels powerful. It was clear that she was inhabiting herself more fully, and I encouraged her to stay with that sense of power in her body. There's a firmness in my belly and lower back. My mind is clear and the helplessness is gone. And how about Tom? Right now, are you still hating him? Tom? She said, as though she were having a hard time remembering him. I'm not even aware of Tom right now. When settled in herself, Tom's behavior wasn't such an issue. Consciously experiencing her hatred instead of keeping it buried allowed Jane to unlock the power that was sealed up in it. And connecting with this power helped her start holding her ground when Tom wasn't there for her, instead of collapsing into resentful victimhood. This allowed her to speak her truth with him more directly, without the blame that usually triggered a fight. At the end of all this work, Jane said, I've been craving the experience of Tom being open to me, but now I realize I haven't been open to myself, especially in the places of hurt and fear and anger and hatred. It's amazing how when I do open to myself in these places, the urgent craving for Tom's love subsides, because at least I have myself, and that's a lot. It's important to recognize that acknowledging anger or hatred does not mean, yes, it's right to be angry, I should feel hatred, I'm justified in feeling this way or in taking it out on someone. Instead, it means, yes, anger and hatred are there, stored up in my body and mind. And since they're there, yes, I can acknowledge them, give them room, and consciously experience them. You may imagine that acknowledging feelings of anger or hatred will make you a more hateful or vengeful person, but in fact, the reverse is true, as long as you consciously relate to the hatred as your own experience, rather than using it as a weapon for blaming and attacking the bad other. Denying or resisting your anger or hatred sets up an opposition within you that squelches your energy and diminishes your power. This keeps the aggression frozen inside you. Yet when you can open to and stay present with the aggression, you free up the energy and power locked up in these feelings. The key is to give the energy of the anger or hatred plenty of room, and to ride the wave of that energy without focusing so much on the person with whom you're upset. Doing this lets you step out of the aggrieved victim role. In this way, you find, paradoxically, that directly experiencing your hatred helps free you from hatred. Hatred actually contains its own intelligence and truth. It is a signal that we are cut off from ourselves and the power of our being. This is what we most hate, feeling cut off from our power, our juice, our freedom, our ease, because of this bind we're in with another person. Through facing and directly experiencing the hatred, we can begin to decode the specific message that is hidden within it. One day, I asked the students in my group to explore their hatred in a conscious and deliberate way by first acknowledging the feeling in their body and then seeing what exactly they most hated in their relationships. These were a few of their responses. I hate it when you turn away from me. I hate it when there's no space for me in this relationship. I hate it when you tell me how to be. I hate it when you don't hear me. I hate losing myself when I try to please you. I hate the deadness I feel when I'm with you. What my students most hated was how small and shut down they felt around another person. They were essentially saying, I hate the way I shrink and lose touch with my own juice when I'm with you. And the crucial positive message hidden within their hatred was, I want myself back. I don't want to let myself be so overwhelmed by how I feel with you that I lose myself. That is a statement of power. Hatred is, at bottom, a cry for help, a cry for attention from a place in us that feels lost and disempowered. Recognizing hatred as a sign of disempowerment and helplessness allows us to make friends with it instead of regarding it as something evil. It becomes destructive only when we turn it into a weapon to use against ourselves or others. Kind understanding. What continues to fuel our grievance against other people is our aversion to the intense emotions, especially hurt, anger, and hatred, they trigger within us. Thus, to lay down our grievance and live at peace with the human race, or the person we live with, it's essential to make friends with these feelings. Learning to allow and open up space around the intense feelings and sensations in our body is a profound act of kindness that starts to melt down the ice of resentment that hardens the heart. This inner kindness lets us take a further step in letting go of grievance, bringing understanding to the childhood circumstances in which our love wound originally formed. A very special type of understanding is essential here, what I call kind understanding or feeling understanding, because it flows from the heart rather than from purely mental comprehension. Why didn't your parents love you better? Why was their love so conditional or inconsistent? If you consider your parents not from the perspective of the aggrieved child, but from that of an understanding adult, what you see are people who are hurt and wounded, just like you. They also had their own share of burdens. They were struggling to make ends meet, keep their marriage together, and find themselves and their own way. All of these constraints and stresses made it hard for them to be there more fully for you. In a tribal culture, others in the tribe, aunts, uncles, cousins, grandparents, neighbors, would have been there to take up the slack when your parents were not up to the task. But in our culture, the nuclear family is on its own, and the culture itself provides little wisdom, help, or guidance in raising children in a healthy way. So all the weight was on your parents to give you what you needed, and it was too much for them, given the other burdens they were carrying. No wonder their love seemed inconsistent and unreliable, and no wonder you came to distrust love. On top of everything else, your parents had their own legacy of not knowing they were loved, which made it hard for them to love themselves. When parents don't love themselves, they inevitably wind up using their children to shore up their shaky self-esteem. It requires a high degree of maturity to let loved ones be the unique separate people that they are, with their own different needs, perspectives, and feelings. So, to the extent that your parents were not fully evolved themselves, they couldn't let you be who you were and simply love you for that. This doesn't mean they were bad. Not knowing and loving oneself, not being confident in the beauty of one's own nature, is a general affliction that has been passed down through the generations. Your parents simply suffered from the same malady that afflicts everyone. Like everyone else, they were helpless in the face of their own conditioning. Kind understanding is not a way to make excuses for your parents or condone the ways they were hurtful to you. Rather, recognizing that your parents' hurtful or negligent behavior arose out of their own wounding and lack of self-love is a step in liberating yourself. What does it feel like to see your parents' woundedness without either justifying or condemning their behavior? They could not know or love you any better than they knew and loved themselves. If you have a little feeling of understanding for them and what they were up against, even the tiniest glimmer, this will help free you from the burden of grievance that you carry. Not taking it personally. Just as your parents' imperfect love was not their fault, because they had no control over that, so too the lack of love that flowed your way is not your fault. In fact, it has nothing to do with you. For in truth, there are very few people in this world who have the capacity to truly see or know you as you are. No one else can see you or your beauty in a consistently accurate way. Your beauty is not a tangible thing, but a subtle inner quality that is often not visible from the outside. There is no way to free yourself from the mood of unlove and the mood of grievance as long as you take it personally when others treat you badly. Taking it personally means imagining that it indicates something about who you are, As long as you take it personally when others don't see or appreciate you, you keep yourself imprisoned in the mind of the aggrieved child. So when people treat you in negligent or hurtful ways, you could practice seeing their unkindness as a symptom of their inner tension and distress, arising out of their own inner disconnection. The man who tailgates you and insults you as he passes in his car is only acting out his own inner turmoil. He is in so much pain and stress that it clouds his consciousness. Unloading on you is a way of trying to reduce his tension and find some relief inside. If you take it personally, then you let his emotional turmoil enter your system and poison you. But if you don't take it personally, this frees you from the victim mind state. If your pain or anger comes up despite your best intentions not to take things personally, then don't take that personally either. Hurt and anger are just feelings, responses in your body arising out of your very human sensitivity to the events around you. You don't have to make them mean something bad about you. The more you work with hurt and anger in the ways described earlier, the more freedom you will have with these feelings. Then you can give them space, breathe into your belly, and open yourself to their energy as they move through you. The Taoists have a famous teaching story about an empty boat that rams into your boat in the middle of a river. While you probably wouldn't be angry at an empty boat, you might well become enraged if someone were at its helm. The point of the story is that the parents who didn't see you, the other kids who teased you as a child, the driver who aggressively tailgated you yesterday, are in fact all empty, rudderless boats. They were compulsively driven to act as they did by their own unexamined wounds. Therefore, they did not know what they were doing and had little control over it. Just as an empty boat that rams into us isn't targeting us, so too people who act unkindly are driven along by the unconscious force of their own wounding and pain. Until we realize this, we will remain prisoners of our grievance, our past, and our victim identity, all of which keep us from opening up to the more powerful currents of life and love that are always flowing through the present moment. Not taking it personally when someone hurts us is a profound practice of compassion, for ourselves first of all. It provides a breath of relief, allowing us to relax and let be in moments when our first impulse is to freeze up or lash out. Loving kindness. Despite all the ways in which your parents failed to love you perfectly, you are only as healthy as you are today because of the ways they did care for you. Granted, their caring wasn't consistent, but if they hadn't shown you any kindness at all, you would not be well enough to be sitting here listening to this audiobook. You might be in an institution somewhere, or be a homeless person or a serial killer. So if you are relatively sane at all, this means that you most likely had what D.W. Winnicott calls good enough parents. If you find this hard to accept, you probably have more work to do unpacking and making friends with the hurt and anger you are carrying from the past. In the final year of my mother's life, as it became apparent that she was on the decline, I was introduced to a powerful Tibetan contemplative practice that involves remembering the kindness of one's mother. The Tibetans use this as a first step toward developing compassion for all beings. Of course, this is easier for Tibetans because they cherish their mothers unequivocally. Like those of many American men, my feelings for my mother were clouded and ambivalent. My mother's decline forced me to come to terms with an unpleasant reality that had marked my whole life, my grievance about her not being able to see or respect me as separate and different from her. All my life, I had also felt burdened by her suffering and by wanting to make her feel better so that I would feel better myself. And I had failed at that task, which left me filled with guilt and resentment. Again and again, I had suffered the consequences of holding on to my grievance against her, the worst of which was my difficulty in letting myself be loved. When I discovered this practice of remembering the kindness of my mother in the last year of her life, I felt immediately attracted to it. Though I had worked on my relationship with her in therapy with some success, This practice provided a simple, concrete method to reorient my whole attitude toward her. Letting myself remember and recognize all the countless ways she had shown me kindness helped me release my bad other projections on her. I came to accept